You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. And if you're interested in purchasing the book, it is available in the lobby thanks to the library store, and proceeds from those purchases go back to the library. Joining Brian on stage tonight are Erica Huggins, Norma Matsume, Phyllis Jackson, and Melina Abdullah. So after their conversation, there's time for a brief Q&A with you, our audience. So be thinking of your questions. If you do have one, raise your hand. We will come to you with a microphone. Please wait for it, as we are actually recording this program for podcast and video, so we'd love to get your voice recorded as part of that. And those recordings will be available on our site and through the library so that audiences far and wide can access tonight's program. I also wanted to say a special thank you to Yusef Omowale from the Southern California Library for his generosity in helping us think about tonight's program. I encourage all of you to explore their extensive archival material on community resistance, housed in an amazing five-decade-old library in South LA. You also might enjoy exploring the LA Public Library's archive of Black Panther Party legacy through our photo collection. All of that's available online. And finally, after tonight's program, in the coming days, we will be sending you a survey electronically so that we can get your feedback from this evening and any other notes you'd like to share about our series. So thanks in advance for keeping your eyes out for that. And so in turning to tonight, many of you probably already know that back in 1968, then FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover described the Black Panther Party as the greatest threat to internal security of the country. And yet, what was little known about the party, due to intentional efforts to keep such info from the public's eye, was the radical grassroots activism that was spearheading so many free programs, from breakfast for school children, free health clinics, and community schools, among many others. And at the core of this programming were the women of the party. And it's these stories, among many others, that Brian Shih's book so beautifully illustrates through his striking photographs and the first-person testimony of the party's often unseen and unheard rank-and-file members. It is precisely the behind-the-scenes work that these people that sustained the Black Panther Party and the lives of so many. These are the untold stories. Tonight, we'll hear from Erica Huggins, leader of the Los Angeles chapter of the party, director of the Oakland Community School, and ongoing mentor, educator, and activist. We'll learn from LA native Norma Matsume, former minister of finance, about how she ran a health clinic and later founded many health service organizations in South LA, including Shields for Families, now 25 years strong. We'll hear from Phyllis Jackson, a former Panther communication secretary and voter registration campaign officer, who is now a professor of art history and African film at Pomona College, where she teaches courses on decolonization. And she's also to thank for providing all of us tonight with a copy of the Panther 10-point platform program. Pick one up in the lobby if you missed it on your way in. And joining our discussion to bridge Panther history to the present moment is local organizer of the LA Black Lives Matter chapter, Melina Abdullah. Melina is professor and chair of Pan-African Studies at Cal State University. And when not on campus, you'll often find her on the front line of local protests against police brutality in our community. Guiding us tonight in the conversation is photojournalist Brian Shee, co-editor of the previously mentioned book, and also a former contributor to the Financial Times and National Public Radio in Japan. His portraits from this project are currently on view at the Oakland Museum of California in the recently opened exhibition, All Power to the People, Black Panthers at 50. And so, in a moment, when our country just celebrated the opening of the National Museum for African American History in DC, and yet today, October 13th, 2016, the lead story in the LA Weekly is that the County of Los Angeles has had more than 1,300 police shootings since the year 2000, with no officers charged, so many questions remain unanswered. There is so much work yet to be done, but tonight we're starting here. Please join me in welcoming our esteemed guest to the Allowed Stage at the LA Public Library.
Good evening, and thank you very much for being here. I think your presence is a testament to the ongoing fascination and love that people show towards the Black Panther Party on the eve of the 50th anniversary. It's my distinct honor and pleasure to be here with all of you. Over the past 4 years, I photographed and interviewed 45 Black Panther members, and it was the richest and deepest experience I think I've had in my life. It was an incredible education, and I will be forever indebted to the trust that you showed me, not only in sitting for a portrait in very uncomfortable situations in a full studio setting, but also telling me your stories. And so just to jump into some of what those stories are, I've asked each of our panelists to read an excerpt from their interviews in the book. And from Melina Abdullah, I found a recent interview that she gave, and I asked her to read a segment from that interview as well, just by way of introduction. So first we'll start with Erica Huggins.
Thank you, Brian. I mean, really, thank you for your book. It's beautiful. In some instances, it's the first time our voices, with quotations, you know, are in print. And it's amazing to read the stories throughout the book. So thank you again. So the excerpt, there were many threatening things within the party and definitely outside of the party. But the community programs were the light of everybody's experience who had anything to do with them. That's how I reconcile all of it. The school was a major pilot for what education could be. That's the Oakland Community School. The busing to prisons program made a difference in the lives of people so that a father or mother would not lose contact with their babies, their children, and their loved ones. The People's Free Medical Clinic saved lives, and the sickle cell anemia research and education programs as well. So you asked me to elaborate. It would take time from everybody. I mean, there is so much to say. But in one sentence or so, few people know about the 65 community survival programs or service to people programs that the Black Panther Party created and sustained. And those of us here helped to sustain those programs. Not just one of them, but many of them, because we had so many tasks. One person had so many tasks, right? Yeah. Woof. And I just want to remind you, if you already know, we were median age, 19 years old. So that's all I want to say for now.
Can I? Let me just ask a follow-up. Why do you think so many people did not know about the programs?
It was the intent of the FBI COINTELPRO to discredit, disrupt, and the word further neutralize us. And J. Edgar Hoover did say what Maureen said about the party being the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. But he also later said that it wasn't that we were talking about self-defense. It was that breakfast program. That's what he said. And so we didn't know the name COINTELPRO, but we were stalked and we were surveilled by, physically stalked, surveilled, demeaned, threatened, beaten, and some of us were killed. But those programs continued because they came from the people and they were what we were asked to do.
Thank you. Norma Umtume?
Okay, my excerpt is, we actually had two nonprofit corporations, Educational Opportunities Corporation, or EOC, and for the Oakland Community School and other educational activities, and EOC Service Corporation, which provided youth and senior activities, food programs, and everything else that wasn't educational. I was keeping the books on those along with the party's records. At the same time, we were applying for grants and talking with public officials to find out what other kinds of programs we could get involved with. We figured we had to get involved in the mainstream somehow in order to get the money to sustain some of our operations. Money coming in from the newspaper had to go toward reprinting the newspaper and taking care of people in the party and the facilities. So we needed to come up with another mechanism to bring in money, and that meant becoming more mainstream so we could start getting grants. It was actually a really big, very sophisticated operation for some, by that time, 24, 25, 26-year-olds to be running. When I read back over this, we were laughing earlier, and I said that? I said mainstream? I said mainstream? Said we were anything but mainstream, but I guess in the eyes of other folks, that's what it's like when you go and you apply for government funding, and we actually got government funding. But it was so important because, well, we all know that programs cost money. And what we were bringing in by collecting donations on the street and selling newspapers, it had to just take care of the basic operations of the party to make sure folks had a place to live, they had clothes, they had food, and to reprint the newspaper again. So that's my piece about the finances, but I also ran party clinic here in Los Angeles and in Berkeley, and that was a major piece of my education for what I've gone ahead and done later in life.
Could you expand on that last point a little bit? How did your Panther experience translate into what you did after the party?
Well, it was getting to know what a nonprofit corporation was. We were running programs. We just didn't have a 501c3, the designation that nonprofits had, that nonprofits have now, and the designation for the state of California. You have to have both of them in order to be a fully nonprofit corporation. So I learned what that was about, and I learned the record keeping and the accounting, but since then, here in Los Angeles, I helped to start up another medical clinic, the UMA Community Clinic. It started off as a free clinic, like the party clinics did, but it's gone on to become a federally qualified health center now, which is a real designation where you get higher reimbursement rates from the feds, and so that's a big thing. And I just noted some of the skills that I acquired while I was in the party. bookkeeping and accounting and financial management, human resources because I had people to supervise, administrative services and facility management. I had to make sure that the rents got paid, that the notes got paid, and when things got broken, we had to call in folks to fix it. Graphic arts, I learned to do, we did everything ourselves. We had our own little print shop and whatnot. And working with diverse populations, that was a real key, something really key for me going on with my work here in Los Angeles. Grant writing and grant administration, just to name a few things. But like Erica said, we had a lot of hats. We worked hard.
Thank you. And Phyllis Jackson?
I actually would like to add on to something that Norma said. I actually was one of the CEOs for EOC, or Educational Opportunities Corporation. And I have to just say, when you talk about learning things, I didn't know what a CEO was when I was told you were going to be CEO. Okay, I'd heard of people being the boss, and I'd heard of people being the president, but I actually didn't even know what a CEO was when I was actually assigned to be a CEO. Okay. I'd also like to say one. I really want to thank Brian also for doing this. I don't do a lot of stuff in print or in public about the party. I do it on college campuses, but not necessarily any place outside the academy. And when I agreed to do this, I actually had to write him an email after I got the book and say, I owe you an apology, because I thought it was going to be a much smaller project than this. I thought it was going to be a nice, quiet little project that not a lot of people would pay attention to.
Like a school project. Like a school project.
Right, I did it. I actually wrote him an email and said, and I don't do many emails either. And I just said, I think I owe you an apology. And what was your response?
My response.
Nobody expected this.
Nobody expected this.
What?
Nobody expected this.
Well, it was actually a surprise to everyone, but I really want to thank you. And I also think that the way in which you organize the book is really powerful and important. Not only do you have individual stories from people who were in the party, but you also have those short essays in there from people who have done research and writing on the party before, and I think it helps put a lot in context. You also have in the book a copy of the 10-point program and platform. And what I think a lot of people don't realize about the 10-point program and platform is that it was revised. So I made some copies for you, because I think it's really important for people to understand that in 1966, the party saw the world in one way. But by 1972, there were some dramatic changes that had taken place. And you can begin to see some of those changes if you just pay attention to the ways in which our language actually changes, our ideology changes, and our worldview changes, as well as our strategies. So I just wanted to give you a way of seeing that. And one of the first things you'll note is that a lot of the sexist language is taken out, or the masculinist language, and what we replace it with. And also there was just a focus on black people. But in the revised version from 72, we're talking about all poor and oppressed people, not just black people. And we're talking about not the white man out of our community, but getting capitalists out of our community. And with that, I'll read mine. Revolutionaries are made, not born. They have to construct their lives consciously along a set of revolutionary principles. Bringing about change is something that all of us can do, or being active in an organization is something all of us can do. We don't have to be the hero when we join. You become the hero through practice. It's not that I'm a bold person, it's that I practice being bold. All of us can practice that. I'm actually a really shy person with bold moments. Those are conscious. You actually have to work against your childhood training. You have to work against whatever you were born with. That was possible for me through a set of principles that still stand today. The 10-point platform and program as theoretically sound, historically appropriate responses to the interlocking systems of domination that control our lives. Now,
this is shy Phyllis.
Now this is the practice part. I mean, what's so funny is that in April of 69, I was a synchronized swimmer in Central Washington State College in Washington State, okay? And by 1969, I joined the Black Panther Party, okay? In December of 68, I was a debutante, okay? I know it's embarrassing now, right? But I just want to give a sense of how fast things were moving at the time, right? And how quickly one can come to an awakening. Growing up in Tacoma, Washington, I wasn't the kind of person that ever was exposed to a single solitary bit of information about Black writers. Even though I was named Phyllis, my father didn't tell me until I was 50-some years old that he named me after Phyllis Wheatley. And so I want to give us a sense that in that period, I had never even heard of Malcolm X until I took a Black Studies class at Central Washington State College. It was the first year they were offering it. And I was assigned to read this thing called The Autobiography of Malcolm X. And I think it's really important to get, but remember, that's 69. He was assassinated in 65. And so I think it's really important to get a sense also of how important the role of Black Studies was in contributing to raising the awareness of people of African descent in this country and other people also. So for me, what I continue to do in the work that I do even today is although I'm situated in art history, every course I teach is a course that is also a Black Studies course, or what we now call Africana Studies. And I think that's important because part of what I think is important to do is to continue those same principles. In the interview, I also say that I was a really good girl. I often say I gave up the Ten Commandments. How soon we forget. I gave up the Ten Commandments for the 10-point program and platform. And in that process, one of the things I think is important to transmit to the next generation are some of those fundamental principles that we learned in the Black Panther Party. And for me, those fundamental things were to recognize that capitalism was a destructive force in society, and that anti-capitalism was an important position to take, and that the way to do that was through a socialist agenda. And so I think it's important to recognize that the party really did, as it developed, became not just a Black community organization, but also an organization that ideologically understood we needed a different approach to our political economy. Is it too close? Okay. The other thing I think is important to recognize about the Black Panther Party, because the last thing I say is that notion of interlocking systems of domination. And for me, that means that you look at not only issues of class, also you look at issues of race, which I think means you have to look at the way white supremacy is produced and reproduced in our society. And we'll get back to that when we get to notions of image making, because it's really done through the visual is the primary mode, how many of us get our ideas for our imagination. I also think it's important to recognize that the party was very much against the notion of patriarchy and traditional roles for men and for women in society and different notions about what it means to be a man or a woman. The party was also very specifically, and these are all things I learned after I stopped synchronized swimming, that heterosexism was another system that dominated and controlled our lives. And the party was very early aligned itself with the gay liberation movement. So I did gender, race, class, sexuality, ability. We did that too. We did so many different things. We were very much on the front lines of working with handy able people in the Bay Area and working with, what was the name of the program again? Center for Independent Living. Because some of our members themselves were, one member, Glenn Lomax, was in a wheelchair. And that made us realize we had to begin to look at what was happening with people who were not fully able physically, because Glenn was a brilliant person. Interlocking systems of domination. What have I missed? You guys are out there. Gender, race, class, sexuality, and capitalism. I think I got them all. Okay. So does that help?
Okay. Beautiful. Malina Abdullah.
So before I read the statement, I just want to say thank you for including me. Thank you for your work. We know that Black Lives Matter, this piece of Black liberation struggle that we inherit, comes from somewhere, and it comes in large part from your work. So thank you for your work. Thank you for being willing to mentor us into the roles we now find ourselves in. We really appreciate you, and we honor you, and I'm thankful to be here, and I'm in awe of all of you, and hope to continue to learn these lessons from you all.
Thank you.
So this is from an interview, and as I read it, I would have changed some of these words, and I will after I read it. What we've sought to do over the past 3 years is really conceive of ourselves as a movement rather than a moment. How do we transform a system that's embedded into the very fiber of this country? And so we're seeking not to simply reform, but the transformation of public safety and policing in this country. And so that's the work we're seeking to do. We're fundamentally a peace movement, if we think about it. What we're saying is that we don't want a violent system of policing that kills Black people with impunity. We want to transform our public safety system into one of peace, one that actually protects and serves and helps our communities, all of our communities, but especially our Black communities, to grow and flourish and prosper. And so what I'd add is the work that we're doing, and I want to acknowledge my Black Lives Matter comrades who are here, Paula, Nia, Mina, Savannah, Amara, and Angela. So I pray that I represent us well. I think that in reading this, I want to clarify a couple of things. When we say that we want to transform the system of public safety, we're really kind of zooming out and looking at public safety more holistically, right? So we believe in the abolition of policing as we know it. We don't believe that we need the kind of policing system that we have, you know, in this nation, but especially here in Los Angeles. As a member of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, we recognize that it was Maureen noted that in LA County there were 1,300 police shootings over the past several years. Right here in Los Angeles City, we know LAPD leads the nation in the killing of its people. So, and they have for 3 years running, right? So we believe when we think about that, it's not a system that can simply be reformed. If anybody's been reading the paper or watching the news lately, there's a lot of rhetoric floating around police reform, and they're going to be more transparent. We don't believe being transparent in the killing of Black people is freedom, right? We think ending the killing of Black people at the hands of the state is part of how we get to freedom, right? So we believe in zooming back and saying, well, what really creates safe and healthy communities? So we really believe in the investment in the kinds of programs that you're talking about. LA spends 54% of its city budget on police. What would happen if we reallocated those resources and said that we need community clinics, right? We need after-school programs. We need arts programs. We need livable wage jobs. We need permanent housing, right? And an end to gentrification downtown, right? What would happen if we did that? And we know that academic studies, virtually all of them, say that's actually how you build safe and healthy communities. And so that's the work that we're seeking to do. So in the quote, when I'm talking about peace, I'm talking about peace in those terms. We also are kind of arriving at that we also have a right to self-defense. And peace sometimes requires self-defense. Now, I don't want anybody to think I'm advocating, you know, some of the things that we're also hearing in the news, right? But when we think about creating safe communities, about a week and a half ago, an 18-year-old boy named, and I'm going to call him a boy because he was 18, Carnell Snell was killed in the hundreds in South Los Angeles. And what we saw, and Angela and I were both went out almost immediately, what we saw is the police descend on a community where they had just killed one of our young people, and by all witness accounts, shot him in the back 5 times, descend on the community with military equipment, right? Self-defense is about saying we don't want you in our communities. We want to secure our communities from you. And that's how we build peace, right? That we have the power and the wisdom and the know-how and the intuition and the sacred duty to defend our own communities and create safe and healthy communities ourselves.
Thank you.
Could I get in on that?
Sure.
I think that that's a really amazing sort of moment that you've had to come to. We didn't call ourselves a peace organization by any stretch of the imagination. We were looking for a revolutionary change, and that's what I was forgetting. And I was talking earlier about interlocking systems. The party was very much against imperialism and aligned itself not only with imperialism, but with anti-colonial movements. And so from our perspective, we looked and saw our models as Che Guevara, you know, Chavez, Ho Chi Minh, Mao. We saw people who had successful revolutions against Western European imperialism. And we saw ourselves as victims of U.S. imperialism. I wouldn't use the word victim today. But people who were subject, like a colony, inside the belly of the beast. And that's what we thought we had to do, was align ourselves with more revolutionary struggles. So it's interesting to hear you say that you guys are beginning to have a sense of what does it mean to have self-determination, which is the first point on the 10-point program and platform, right?
Just really quick,
I think
it's important, too, that we also understand that we're now in a moment where I was reading Akinyele Umoja's We Will Shoot Back on the plane, which was a bad move. Don't ever read that book on the plane, right? Because everybody was, like, they actually stopped at my row, and I wound up putting the book away. So some of what we say is conscious of the moment that we're in, that we understand, we do understand it's not COINTELPRO now, but it's not called that anymore, but we understand surveillance, we understand what... And it's more than that. Like, all of us have, we understand what we're facing, and so it's really important that we kind of watch how we're perceived and what some movement lawyers call like the building of the 10-year case, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're conscious of that as well.
That's great.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add on that the passage that Melina read was from an interview, and right after she read that, the interviewer was trying to kind of suck you into some kind of taking responsibility for the recent shootings in Dallas of the five police officers saying, like, don't you feel responsible for this? As if Black Lives Matter somehow was directly responsible for the actions of this one person who had nothing to do with Black Lives Matter, which she handled admirably. I admired your restraint in your answer. And it brings up this idea of image. And how do you, when you're advocating for this kind of change, that many people, the most powerful people in the country, have an interest against changing, and they have an interest in defining you in a way that you don't see yourselves. How did the image of the Panthers, how has it changed over time? What kind of actions did you take at that time to define your own image? And since then, what have you been doing to claim the Panther image as your own?
I think one of the most important ways in which the Black Panther Party worked to define its image was through its publication of its weekly newspaper. Which, if you watch the mastheads, one of the things you'll see is that it starts out as a Black community organization newspaper, a Black community newspaper, and it ends up the intercommunal news service, so that you can actually chart the ideological shifts in the Black Panther Party by just looking at the masthead of the party in many ways. And I think that you mentioned the fact that we printed our own posters, our own cards. But we also had people. There's this one guy named Benny Harris who was this absolute genius. Wouldn't speak to too many people at all, but he actually took two old presses, pulled the parts from one, and built a brand new press for us. I know we didn't print the paper on that. That we had to take to someone else, but it allowed us to print all of our materials. So we would create the kinds of cards for our use and for other people's use that weren't Hallmark-like, you know. like revolution in my lifetime kind of a stuff versus mom, how are you doing today, right? Or it would be Bunchy's poem would be on a palm. So we worked really hard at one, I think, and this is probably one of the most important things, is changing the image is changing your own image of who you are as a person first. I think that's one of the things that the party gave many people was the ability to literally decolonize their mind and to repopulate it with unapologetic appreciation for blackness, unapologetic appreciation for the working folk, unapologetic for the unemployed, the so-called unemployables, and to celebrate those people in this culture who are usually dismissed and devalued. And I think that's one of the things that we did. So we ended up creating like music groups, and the name of them were, it was the Lumpin'. You guys know what that is, right? That's in a Marxist analysis, the revolutionary force should be the proletariat. But for Marx, the unemployables, the lumpin', were the ones who were not going to be useful to the revolution because they weren't necessarily the workers. But for us, we celebrated the lumpin'. And so I think it's through, if you look at the paper, begin to look at some of the imagery Emory created to actually visualize our ideology, I think that would help.
I think the very fact that you were unapologetic was very threatening to the powers that be. And that, you know, that's where this tension in how the Black Panther Party was presented to the public and in this popular image of usually men, armed men, mm-hmm. out to overthrow white America. Mm-hmm. And what did you do to struggle against, besides that, like on a, I guess on a day-to-day basis, how did you counteract that? And what advice would you give to Black Lives Matter, who is still trying, I think, to define its image, which in some ways is more difficult because the organization is more diffuse?
In retrospect, and even thinking about the way things are today, I saw folks in the party as visionaries, and they were the implementers. I was an implementer back at that time, a visionary in training. But on a day-to-day basis, you just didn't really think about that kind of stuff. Mm. I didn't. I was about getting up at 5:30 or 6, you do your breakfast program, then you clean up whatever situation you're living in, and then you go to do your job all day, and then you come back at 6, 7, or 8, and you might have political education class, or you have some dinner if there's some left, and you had to do security for a couple of hours at night, and so you had 2 or 3 hours to sleep, and you were up doing it all over again, and so all this high-level thinking, That's not how my mind worked. And so I was about, you know, being the best I could be each day. And to me, that was the kind of image that I wanted people to have of the party, that we were hard workers and we were really serious about the work that we were doing for the community. And I mean that's how I lived my time in the party.
Well, I've been thinking about whether to say this or not, and so I will. I want to say that it was in the Black Panther Party that I learned how deeply embedded gender bias and sexism and misogyny run in our culture. And it didn't come on with the enslaved Africans. I don't think so. I think we came into a culture of violence, and I've been thinking about it as we each are talking. This is a violent culture. And if we're paying attention in October 2016, we just really have to admit that that has always been so. And I remember that when I have three children and I was pregnant with my daughter, I was in Los Angeles chapter, but for some reason, John Huggins and I went to Oakland for something, and I was pregnant. And if you've never been pregnant, let me tell you that you want food a lot. So I'm in this office, and I won't name names, and these wonderful women, and these were like the most amazing women were in the Black Panther Party, by the way, who came not to posture, not to learn how to use a gun, but to serve the people, body and soul, like you were just saying. There's a thread running through everything that we're saying, including you, Melina. You have four children, right? Three children. I mean, as I think about you now, I wonder, how did I do it then? How are you doing it now? And at any rate, so I'm pregnant, and it's dinner time, and the women have cooked. Now, I had some about that, because why weren't the brothers cooking? I thought to myself, but I didn't say anything, because I was from Los Angeles. So,
we didn't roll that way.
No. You eat, you want to eat, you cook. So all of a sudden, one of the young women came out of the kitchen. She said, all right, brothers, you can eat now.
What?
Oh, no, it's not going to be like that. I'm pregnant, I'm going to eat. Sister, excuse me. I went to the kitchen and I ate. Now, you can choose not to think of this as a revolutionary act, but in fact it was in that environment at that time. But I didn't do it because I thought it was revolutionary. It was what was in front of me. It made no logical sense. No, don't tell me it's from Africa. No, it's not. Please. It is just an expression of sexism. There isn't any other way to describe it. And I think that from that day forward, I was quite aware. I don't know if I was visionary. Some of it was just, how do we speak to one another? How do we treat one another? Since the party was established from a feeling of love for the people, how is it loving for us to treat one another in that way? One of the things I love about Black Lives Matter is I've talked to people over time who are directly involved, is that you all work on taking care of yourselves. Did we sleep? You said 3 hours.
I know.
We ate when we... I don't know. And I don't think that we had the foresight, I know that I didn't, to take really good care of myself or my children because I didn't see myself as part of the people. I'm saying these things because I think if there are activists there who think that you can do it like that, you cannot. It is not healthy, and it is also heartbreaking in the long term. So, however, my budding feminism was there. Now, we didn't have any deep love for the white women's movement of the era, but we certainly knew when we were being treated differently as women. And this was throughout the history of the party. We spoke up as best we could. So I wanted to point that out because here we are, Brian, with the exception of you. Well, how do you identify?
I thought I would take this occasion. I'm good. Go ahead. I changed my mind.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, when I think about Black Lives Matter, three queer women of color began that beautiful conceptual phenomenon. And women in the Black Panther Party was a different era, was a different time, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I think you were, well, when you mentioned all of the things that we dealt with, Phyllis, I was thinking about Huey's 1970 essay called On the Women's Movement and the Gay Liberation Movement. 1970, a Black man wrote that. Yeah. Amazing. Just amazing. And so we struggled with all kinds of things. That's how I want to put it. We struggled with it. We didn't come to any understanding. And so sometimes people think that then in 1970 or 72 or even 77, we should have been more feminist because they're pulling us out of a period of time and superimposing I don't know if it's a realistic evaluation of this time. So I hope that I've made sense in what I'm saying, but it's like there's a bunch of threads running through our conversation.
Well, I have a slightly different experience than Erica. I saw the Black Panther Party as a place that actually was liberatory for me as a woman when I joined. It was a very different experience. I'm not saying that there weren't men who were, we used to call male chauvinist pigs, that there weren't people who carried chauvinism into the party with them. All of us come out of communities, as you say, that are violent, that are patriarchal, that are heteronormative, and we have to try and attempt to negotiate that. But my experience was really somewhat different because I think that I just happened to come right at that moment in 69 after the United Front Against Fascism conference. And the very first meeting I attended was a meeting where a man had in fact hit a woman. The first meeting I got to attend as a Black Panther, a man had slapped a sister, Earlene Coleman. She fell back, cut her heel, and he was brought up on party charges. And he was found guilty. And so for me, it was a place where I saw that men weren't supposed to be a certain way, weren't supposed to be misogynistic. As a matter of fact, it was part of the rules of the party. And I think that the models that I had were the kind of revolutionary struggles, whether it was Cuba or Vietnam or Mozambique, is we saw women as part of the struggle. And this is back to the issue about women. For us, it wasn't about what was the role of women as I was in the party. For me, it was more about what does it mean to be a revolutionary? And are you leading a principled life? And but then within that revolutionary role, we had to deal with our own individual internalized sexism, and we had to deal with the kind of male dominance that might exist. But, you know, when you sleep with a gun under your pillow, people don't tend to mess with you.
And I think that the year that I came was 67. And the other thing about the Black Panther Party is
it grows.
It's ideologically mm-hmm. moves as we move.
Absolutely.
And those struggles that didn't, you know, complete themselves within the party mm-hmm. showed up for you. I'm glad to hear that mm-hmm. because that day in 1967, 68. Might have been the end of 67 going into 68.
Still on Grove Street?
Well, it was someone's house.
Oh, house.
Near the Grove Street office. But the point is, it had to be 68 actually. That it wasn't originally like that.
No, it wasn't.
And I'm glad it was like that for you in 69. Everything was transitioning.
It was transitioning.
When I think about the Oakland Community School, and I think I told you this, Brian, and Norma, you saw it, and I think you did too, Phyllis, and that is that the school itself had different incarnations. Before it was Oakland Community School, it was Intercommunal Youth Institute. And before that, it was called just the Children's House. And before that, it was like a home school in North Oakland. 62nd Street. That was its name. 62nd Street. We didn't call it anything. But that's where... But it was an after-school program and a day program for the youngest ones. But it originated because we had to take our children out of the... Well, party members with older children, elementary school children, had to take their children out of school because adult teachers were treating them in a mean way. Grown-ups. And so, and then the Intercommunal Youth Institute formed slowly thereafter because the community wanted to have their children there. And then the curriculum was different. The teachers were different. Our focus for the children was different. And so by the time we opened our doors for Oakland Community School in 1973-74 school year, it was a different Black Panther Party educational program.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad you said that. There is a book, in case you're interested, that looks at the ideological shifts of the Black Panther Party. It's called Black Against Empire. And it's not too dense to read, but it is a big book. And but it's Waldo Martin and Joshua Bloom. So it's an interesting book if you want to know more about what we're referring to.
Well, you're just real quickly, you were mentioning the school. I want to say we have two of our students who survived. We have three students who survived the Oakland Community School. Erica's daughter, Mai.
Where are you?
Yes. Alicia Keek. Alicia. And Albert, my son.
We used to call them Panther Cubs.
No, but he was Little Al.
They survived all of our madness. They made it out okay, so we're grateful for that.
Could I get one other thing in there? Because I want to make sure that while I do think that, in fact, there were these, we had the struggle of dealing with gender issues within the party, I also think that there were some really powerful men in the party that really worked hard also at learning their own internalized sexism. Yes. And that one of the differences, I think, as you said this, that I began to notice, like I joined the party literally at national headquarters in Berkeley. Then it moved to West Oakland. It was called Central Headquarters. But when I joined, there were two wives, June's wife and Bobby's wife, were making dinner. But really quickly, once again, things transpired. And then you begin to see that most of the cooks became the men. Right? See? Okay. Because they had been in the Army. See, even the kids are shaking their head. Melvin could cook, couldn't he? Or Ellis White. The men oftentimes started doing the cooking because they'd been in the service. They, oftentimes for Black men, where are you? Doing the KP work, as they used to call it, or the kitchen patrol. And so actually, many of them came with skills of cooking in large batches. And so I want to just say once again that there are some really powerful men that were in the party and that all of us had to work to unlearn a lot of the baggage we came into the party with. And I think Erica's point about taking care of yourself is a really important one, that one of the things as sort of Marxist-Leninist combined Maoist is that we sort of left religion alone. But in leaving religion alone, we also left spirituality alone. We didn't make the distinction. And we didn't really spend a lot of time taking care of ourselves because we were so busy doing this, serving the people, body and soul. And it's the one thing I would say to any young organizer today is, yes, you serve the people, body and soul, but you have to take care and tend your own spirit to do that. and we tend to not do that ourselves.
So just in response to that, I'm thinking, I was going in my head, and I'm thinking, I guess we met before there was a Black Lives Matter, because I think I was going through, or I was almost about to get divorced when we met, and didn't know it, but one of the things that you taught me in that drive was, the drive to campus, was the importance of meditation. And that's actually what let me survive the divorce, but it's also something that I think was really deeply rooted into how we birthed Black Lives Matter. So we were very conscious in the birthing of Black Lives Matter, of birthing what we call a womanist Black nationalist organization with a queer and trans lens, right? And so what are the principles of womanism, and how do we kind of uplift that? And so the spiritual practice was really a part of kind of the initial development, and continues to be a part of the work that we do. So spiritual work for ourselves, also spiritual work in terms of it, I think it took about a year and a half for us to figure out that, because there would be this spiritual burden. And when Ezell Ford was killed here in Los Angeles, and so I'm going to just tell it. So we were doing this, what we called Occupy LAPD, and we occupied the front of police headquarters for 18 days. And as we were in the midst of it, I felt this really heavy spiritual energy. And I won't say everything that happened, but what became really clear is that when you talk about responding to the killings of people, there is spiritual energy. And you can't pretend like it's something that you can just engage in through actions, right? There's also spiritual work that has to happen for ourselves and for those spirits whose bodies have been stolen, right? And so we continue to do a lot of that work, pouring of libations, but also the meditative practice. The final thing I'll say just about self-care is we continue to struggle with self-care, because some of us are not, there's a few millennials, there's some millennials, and some of us are not millennials. Some of us are like, I'm not a Panther Cub, but I'm of that same generation, right? And I think there's a tension between overindulgence in self-care, right? The me time stuff, the I'm at, like we hear some of the younger ones, not Nia, but some of the other younger ones saying, I'm at capacity. And I'm like, how you gonna be at capacity? You don't even have no kids, right? Right? Like, so saying there has to be self-care, but it needs to be a collective self-care, right? Like it has to be, it can't be an indulgent self-care. And so we're working out how stuff works, but even how we mother and how we parent shifts. And we were very conscious of that when we, there were several of us who were single moms when Black Lives Matter was born. And so we have a bunch of other mamas. So, you know, Savannah and Amara can come with me, or Angela, or Mama Paula, or whoever, and they know that's Mama for now, right? And so that's part of our self-care as well. So thank you for teaching me that, Erica, the importance of that in doing the work.
Can I have one little thing under that?
One little thing?
We often talk about the notion of love the people, but we oftentimes forget to love ourselves.
We are the people.
And we are, that's what you were saying. And I think that oftentimes we just need to remember, and people don't realize how much love drove what we did, but I don't think that we turn that love on ourselves individually. It was always projected out, and I think it's important for people doing that kind of activism to really work on, and it takes work on respecting who you are as a right. In your own subjectivity.
You were going to say something?
Oh. Thank you very much. I think we could talk for hours. We're going to have some Q&A. You're not done yet. Do you want the last word?
Yeah.
Yeah, hit it.
Just in terms of leaving some wisdom for the young people that are doing this work now, to add on to what Phyllis said, I think that it's important to be very intentional about what you get involved in. Intentional not only about the content or what area it is that you want to do the work in, but also to be intentional about your time commitment. You know, how many hours a day? How many hours a month? Are you going to do this for 6 months? Are you going to do this for a year? We didn't have those kind of options. When we joined the party, we never thought that this would go on and on and on and on. You couldn't say, oh, I'm going to do this for another 3 months, and then I'm going to resign, and I'm going back east and going back to school. It wasn't that kind of a deal. So be intentional and you know, decide how much time. Doesn't mean that you're not committed, and don't let people shame you into feeling like you're not doing your share. Do you. You have to figure out what that means. It doesn't mean that you're not any less passionate than anybody else, but you need to figure out what works for you.
Thank you very much. And we do want to open it up to questions now. And if you could just form your words in a question.
First question over here.
Sure.
Oh. Hello. We thank you for being here and enlightening us. Many of us remember the Black Panthers back in the early, I want to say 60s and 70s. My question is, the vast majority support your cause and your right to demonstrate. When demonstration turns violent and causes harm to people and or possessions, do you feel this fuels a negative stereotype and alienates the cause?
You're talking to Black Lives, because the Black Panther Party doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So you're talking to Black Lives.
Right.
One, there hasn't been an incident where a Black Lives Matter protest or Black Lives Matter organizers have initiated violence. So I think that it's really important that we talk about that and understand that, although we're often framed that way. But second, I think that when we talk about violence, we need to think about the cause of violence, right? That the violence is what we're responding to, not what we're initiating, right? The fact that Black people are walking around right now in 2016 with targets on their backs. My son, who is 6 years old, so I mentioned Occupy LAPD, but we just came off of what we think to be the longest 24/7 encampment in Black history, which was 54 days in front of City Hall. And during that encampment, my son, who's six, there was a heavy police presence constantly. My son, who's six, said to me, "Mama, I'm six, the police can't arrest me, but they can kill me." And you know what I could not say to him? I couldn't say he's wrong. Because Ayanna Stanley Jones was 7 years old when she got killed sleeping on her grandmother's couch by the police. So when we talk about violence, we need to think about the constant violence that Black people are under at the hands of the state. And so we need everyone's help in pushing back against a false narrative that tries to paint those who are resisting violence as the ones who are initiating violence.
So, piggybacking on that, really, do you think movements of the past and current movements, do you really think that things will change without a nonviolent revolution? Do you really think that things will be different? Do you really believe that?
Without a...
Well,
Hi, first of all. And I was hearing that you have the answer to your question.
Thanks for the softball.
No, seriously, I listened very carefully to your question, and I thought your feeling
that it won't
is strong, that that's what is needed. Is that so? Wait just a second for the microphone, because your voice is important.
What I feel is that we have been marching and protesting and marching and for years, and we still have so many of the same issues. So I just wonder, for me, I don't see, of course there are some changes and things are better, but we are still getting killed in the street. There are, things are not that great. So my question is, do I think we need more? Do I think it will change without a revolution? No. But I wondered, what was your opinion on that, especially from someone who has been through years and years and years and years and years of this and seen so much. What do you think about that?
Thank you very much.
And thank you.
I would say that there are incremental changes. Some things do happen. But realistically, and looking back at what we went through, you can't outfire power, the powers that be. That would just be suicide. That's so we have to think of, what do we do in the meantime? What kind of changes can we make? You know, so we're not going to sit up here on stage and say, go out and do something that will have the FBI at our door tomorrow night. You know, because...
And, or at their doors.
Yeah, or at your doors, yeah. You know, that's not what we're saying. That is not what we're saying. Let me make this perfectly clear. But by marching and doing the other type of protesting that we do, change does happen. It's very, very slow. And it would just be suicide to think that you could get up and do something else.
I think you're absolutely right. I don't think that the kind of change that you're hoping for is going to come without there being a kind of revolution in terms of not only the political economy, but the consciousness of other people in terms of the value of black lives. Okay, that's just not going to happen. We need a revolution in that, absolutely. But I don't... I agree completely with you that, you know, we thought we could handle the U.S. government. We found quickly that it was a powerful force. Other people in the world thought so too, right? But I also think that if you think that revolution will end the problem, then what we get is that we realize that even when you go to build a new society, you've got to still work out the same problems, right? We see that happening all across the globe. So I guess the point is we have to begin to think about, what does revolution even mean?
Thank you.
Right?
Thank you.
When you really think about the word revolution, it means to revolve around and around and around and around. So that we have to really start thinking about, what does liberation look like?
Right.
And what are the strategies that we have to take? And I agree. I think that there were moments when I was saddened when I first saw Black Lives Matters. I was saddened. That's the honest truth. I was saddened. And but it was one night I got home from work and looked up and saw, man, them closing about 5 main arteries in New York City. And I said, these young people came up with something that I didn't understand would be useful. You guys raise consciousness of millions of people. You guys. But all of you, right? Even those who were supporting just through not trying to get people to shut them down. So I do think that there's something, and it has to be for each generation to define what revolution looks like. The revolution back in the 60s is not the same kind of revolution that you'll have to have today. And I think that you guys will have to define what it looks like.
Why were you sad?
What?
Why were you sad when you...
I didn't hear. I'm
sorry.
Why were you sad when you heard?
Oh, why was I sad? Oh, because I knew Black Lives Mattered. And it felt... it just felt... Honest, it felt disempowered, right? That someone was out saying Black Lives Matters, and it really unnerved me at first. Just like hands up, don't shoot unnerved
right.
me. You know, we're used to like death to the fascists.
Yeah.
And you know, hands up, don't shoot. It was just a different approach. and I had to grow into my appreciation for what it was Black Lives Matters was doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And it had a different agenda.
Right.
Right.
Well, I also think that it's who we're saying Black Lives Matter
exactly.
to that is sometimes misinterpreted,
mm-hmm.
right? So we're not pleading to
right.
white supremacist, patriarchal, heteronormative capitalism to see us, right?
Say that again.
Right. All those things, right? What we're saying is to us, if Black Lives Matter, what kind of power does that give us, right?
Absolutely.
What does that mean for us,
Absolutely.
Right? One of our chances when we talk about, you talked about the shutdowns, we talk about no justice, no peace, no racist police, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we say, if we don't get it, shut it down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's our thing. It's
right.
if we don't get the justice, we gonna shut you down, and you're not gonna be comfortable going to brunch at Santa Monica Promenade, and you may miss your airplane if we don't get justice, right? And so that's really,
that.
Yeah,
that night, right?
Yeah.
We'll
that's really
my
what
class
we...
for the next semester.
Great.
You know, so I'm just saying that, but it is a difference in terms of what people meant by revolution then and what they mean by revolution now.
Right.
Yeah.
Did we answer your question?
Yeah, you did, actually. And people think when you hear that it's Black people against other people, and it's just good against
the right thing to do, that's what it's about. It's not about race. It's what's the right humane thing to do. So when I think of revolution, it's not a race war. It's a war against what should be done and what's the right thing to do when you're dealing with other human beings. So, but yes, you did answer my question. Thank you. My question is, when you mentioned party charges being brought up, and as a member of Black Lives Matter, certainly there are times that individuals and their egos lead them to actions that are not in line with our common purpose. And so I just kind of wondered what advice that you would offer us as we seek to work with each other in a loving way, but nonetheless, how do you emerge with the collective values intact and avoid the kind of individualist rogue
maybe I'm not
feeling.
Catching your question. Would you?
Okay, so, you know, the brother slaps the sister and she falls back and he's being charged.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
So
committee for methods for
within,
correction.
Right? Okay. Okay. And so I guess what I'm asking is, within any organization, there are always individuals that do things that are out of line with the collective values.
Mm-hmm.
What would you offer as advice in terms of, how to deal with one another, how to encourage accountability within the group? Do you understand?
I wouldn't do it our way. I would not do it the way that...
Don't.
Oh, sorry. I don't necessarily know if I have a suggestion for what you should do. I know I would not offer what we did do, which was to follow the model of dominant culture. And it could be physical, right? So I think that, once again, just like revolution, it's something that you have to figure out for yourself. I mean, it's such a different world now. You're talking to a person who doesn't even own a cell phone. So maybe there's an app for that. I'm not sure. But do you see what I'm saying? Maybe there's something you guys can figure out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read the Black Lives Matter platform. It's beautiful. If you haven't read it, you can find it easily online. At least that's how I found it. It's beautiful. And I just wanted to suggest that you go back to your platform, look at your own language, and see if the behaviors are in alignment with it. Because it's really beautiful. And it reminded me so much of the 10-point program, although it's not 10 points. I live with a certain set of principles now that I didn't always have. So when someone calls my behavior, I look is that in alignment with how I truly want to live? Is it a right action or something else? And but I have to do that inside myself. One of the things that I really loved about Oakland Community School is we had a little committee at Oakland Community School where the children were the peer advisors when something went wrong. And they would ask the person, well, there are a couple of really funny examples of this, but I'll just use one without names. Why do you think you didn't do your homework for 7 days straight? In other words, what was going on? And the little girl said, I don't know. I don't know why. I was just trifling. So what do you think would correct that? Well, maybe I shouldn't watch TV. It was coming from her. That's what I'm talking about. Her own, as we say, agency. She felt empowered in that little committee to say to her peers, we had an adult advisor in the room, but she could say to her peers in conversation without punitive assessment or judgment. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with Phyllis. I wouldn't do it the way we did it. It harmed us all, some of those ways. But at the school, we were able to figure out how to do it differently, at least as best we could. And it was certainly not perfect. So, yeah, that's a great question.
Next question?
Yeah, I'm sure we could talk for hours. I worked on this book for 5 years, and I'm still learning amazing things at this panel. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question, so this will be the last one.
I think we have an amazing opportunity here to have the Black Panthers and Black Lives Matter. I think we could call that an incarnation, a new incarnation of the movement before us tonight, and I think that's, I'm honored. And I think we've witnessed that there's, between these two movements, there's, despite the gap of generation and the span of time, there's a lot that they have in common. And my question for you is, did the movement, are we witnessing a re-blooming of the movement, or did it never go away? Is this, yeah.
As an older person, I'll say that I had to go back to school to realize how long the Black radical or Black revolutionary tradition was, right? To go back and learn about everyone from David Walker to Ida B. Wells. I didn't learn that in school, and I didn't have time to learn it when I was in the Black Panther Party. So I think that, yes, there is a continuation. It's not a strange and unique phenomenon. It's what happens. And I think that one of the things we oftentimes forget is that repression just continues to grow, and what we identify as repression continues to grow, breeds resistance. But resistance will breed more repression. And so that it is always going to be this kind of ongoing struggle to adjust to the times and to deal with whatever has manifested itself as an oppressive condition. I think it's going to be continuous. And I think that their moment right now is a brilliant moment. I applaud them for what they have done to raise awareness about not only the police killing of people, but without any suffering any punishment for it, but also mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. And the role that mass incarceration and the criminalization of bodies in our society has done. And my last thing is that the thing we all learn is that if you want to see how a society is going to oppress people, just look at the history of blackness. And you'll see that those prisons are being continued to build. There are not enough black people to fill them. So everybody better watch out.
And I'd like to add that I don't think that what we were doing, a number of us, I would probably say most of us, ever stopped. It's just that we're not doing it in a collective manner. the work that many of us have continued to do still follows along the 10-point platform and program, and the kind of work that we do in working in communities that hasn't stopped. So it just keeps going.
And the other continuous thread, that was so beautiful what both of you said. The other continuous thread are the allies. The people who are not black or brown or queer. The people who fit the dominant culture profile, who stand up and say, Black Lives Matter. But they don't just say that. They put their resources, their skills, their talents, their connections, and their, sometimes their whiteness, which is capital. They put it to use. This is so important. And I just had to say it. Because we think sometimes that this is a movement that we're all responsible for caring for. I was at the New Smithsonian, and I saw, do I have time to tell this short little, I saw this little girl, your 10-year-old's age, and height, and she was walking with her mother on the floor. You have to go to this museum, but the whole bottom floor is the history and artifacts which show slavery and abolition. There's a little side area where there's a glass encasement, and there's an old piece of cloth. And when you look at it closer, you see that it's blood-stained, but by now the blood is brown. And the little girl goes to the window, and she says, Mommy, Mommy, is that really blood? And the mother of the child says, Yes. The mother's holding the little baby, her little baby as well. And she says, It's John Brown's blood, Mommy. And I stood there and I wanted to cry because I hadn't seen the words under the picture, the cloth yet. And is it his blood, Mommy? And as the mother says, Sugar, just go over there and read it. You can read it for yourself. And she does. And she said, Mommy, is John Brown's blood. Did he die for us? And we know history. Here we are in this library, don't we? So I just want to impress the point about allies. Not people who run the show and tell people what to do and how to do it and give unwanted advice. But people who have your back. Like John Brown. Like Tim Wise. There's so many wonderful people who our allies. So I just want to encourage us all that we have a part to play in this because we are all humans. Unless somebody here was hatched out of an egg. We're all humans, and thereby we have a responsibility. We are of a consequence to one another. We really are. And this world, we'll leave it at some point. What are we leaving for the generation now and the ones to come? So thank you for your question. And thank you all for everything.
Thank you very much for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.